And surpass penetrating and perfect Dharma is rarely met with even in 100,000 million kalpas, having yet to see and listen to remember and accept. I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words.
This is all right?
Yeah.
Are we recording?
Well, good morning.
Good morning.
I know Zach, I know Steve, and you are?
Kelly.
Kelly. And my name is Jim. Or also, my Dharma name is Zenin Soan. So nice to be with you this morning. There's no one there.
No one there. It's small for now.
It's on vacation.
It's a quiet day here in Vallejo. Yeah. Well, I brought this calligraphy today to show you.
I could see it before.
You saw, yeah, before. And this calligraphy was painted by Reverend Reb Anderson, Tenshin Reb Anderson, senior Dharma teacher at the San Francisco Zen Center. And it reads in Japanese, Watashi wa dare, and it means, it translates, who am I? Who am I? And the reason I brought it, well, I gave a talk about it at my Sangha, and this is going to be kind of a different talk. And because I realized this calligraphy had some significance for this Sangha. And the reason that's so is because this calligraphy was among the effects of John Briggs, who was Shuso here in about 2014, shortly before he passed away. And after he passed away, his wife, Karen Briggs, gave this calligraphy to our Sangha. So that's the connection, one of the connections with you and this piece of calligraphy. It was, I don't know what the circumstances of it being given to John were. So I've never asked Reb about it. I never had the particular opportunity to do so, or I didn't take advantage of it in any case. But one of the things that I have been thinking is that why this calligraphy may have been significant to John was part of his biography was that he was a recovering alcoholic. He had been in recovery for quite a few years when I met him, but he, like many alcoholics and people who have been addicted to various things, always considered himself a recovering alcoholic and had been very involved in AA and so forth. And it occurs to me that a person who had that in their past, at the time that they made a decision to change, to stop abusing the substances, whatever they might be, that the question, who am I, might have arisen for them. The question of, is this all, is this my fate? Is this what I'm going to be, am I going to be under this great cloud my whole life? And is this the best I can do? Is this only way to deal with the pain that I feel? is to continue to anesthetize myself with drugs and alcohol. So some questions like that, I think, must arise, and some intention on top of it to answer that question. Like, I do. Who am I? I don't know, but I want to be different than this. You know, I don't want to be this way. And finally, and John talked to me about his history, there were some attempts to, you know, change, and then some falling back, and, you know, some more attempts. And finally, there was, you know, a firm intention that held. And he was able to, and with the help of Zen practice, actually, he was able to, you know, give up alcohol and change his life. So I thought, well, you know, who am I was always a question for John. And one of his answers was, I'm a person in recovery. And I'm devoted to that. I'm devoted to being a person in recovery. And I'm firmly standing on that ground. And, you know, it's a wonderful thing in one's life when one finds some firm ground to stand on, especially ground that is not harming oneself and not harming others. This is a wonderful transformation, if that can happen. And at the same time, thinking about this theme, I realized last night, well, I've been reading this biography of, it's a recently published memoir of a good friend of mine, someone I've known for, I don't know, 40, maybe 50 years or close to 50 years, a really good friend of mine. And she spent 10 years writing her memoirs, and she was in a memoir class and so forth. And now she's published her memoirs, a 300-page book, and, you know, real book. And so I've been enjoying reading that because I've heard parts of her story over the years, and this is kind of filling in the gaps or making it more a fuller story than I ever knew. And her she was someone, she's 9 years older than I am, so she's in her 80s, and so she came of age in the 60s. And after she led a very conventional life, went to college, got a degree in math. She's smart, you know, she's got an aptitude for math. And after college, as many college people do, she decided to take a trip to Europe. And she went to Europe with a girlfriend of hers, and they traveled around. And they ended up in Morocco. And really amazing stories there in Morocco. And then they went back to Spain or someplace, and her girlfriend decided to go back to the U.S., and she decided to stay and go back to Morocco. And she went back to Tangiers, and she met a man who became the first love of her life, and she fell deeply in love with him, and became deeply devoted. Downside was that he was a heroin addict. And so this story recounts really reckless behavior on my friend's part in terms of aiding and abetting this love of hers in his addiction. She didn't try to change him. She surprised herself by becoming so dependent upon him. Well, I don't want to go deeply into that too much, but she did some really reckless things in support of her what ultimately became her marriage.
And then this went on for a few years, and they came back to the U.S. He was an American. At some point, she started asking herself, well, who am I? Who am I separate? Not the wife of my loving husband, the heroin addict, who actually at that point was actually not so loving, but actually more abusive at times. And so she started asking herself that question. Who am I? What is my identity? Separate, independent of this person I love. And she started acting on that, and she went ultimately back to school, obtained a teaching credential, and decided that what she really wanted to do was teach children. And she had a passion for teaching children. And so through the process of questioning herself and questioning what her own destiny was, she was ultimately able to break free from what turned out to be, which she gradually came to realize was, on balance, not a healthy relationship to be in, even though she loved this fellow quite a lot. And she ultimately left him and became a teacher and had a wonderful career as a teacher in an alternative school. So these two stories are kind of, conventional stories of, stories in the conventional world about someone asking themselves, who am I? What do I represent? What is the thrust? What is the direction? What is the passion of my life? And how do I want to live? How do I want to live and be as a person? And I think this is a question that we, all of us, ask ourselves periodically throughout our lives. Who am I? What am I going to be? And what am I going to be now? And now, because we're changing and aging and maturing and going. We're in relationships and so forth. We have to ask ourselves this question throughout our life. Who am I? Who am I now? Now, in terms of, the Orthodox Buddhist answer to this question, this is, after all, Dharma talk. So we must come around to the Dharma. The Orthodox Buddhist answer to this question is that I am a collection. I am an aggregation, right? An aggregation of five things, which are? Right. Five heaps, form, feeling, perceptions, formations, and consciousness. And there's no agent in addition to that. That's a very important teaching. That is the point of this teaching, that there is no agent. There is simply this collection. And in the Buddhist teaching, original teaching, and in Mahayana Buddhism, the five aggregates, the five parts of this collection, are also without an agent. They don't have any substance either. So, in the Buddhist teaching, form is said to be like a ball of foam. Feelings like a bubble. Perceptions like a mirage, karmic formations like
the hollow core of a banana tree. And consciousness like a magic trick. A magic trick. So neither you know, so the Buddha taught, you know, don't mistake this collection, even though I say there is no agent here, there's no unity. Neither is this collection have any substance. Neither the whole nor the parts are substantial and can be labeled as I. So this takes us to, you know, like a deeper. I started out kind of talking about kind of conventional understanding, but then this calligraphy was written by a Zen master, so we have to assume that there is a deeper intent, a deeper motivation, and a suggestion that I believe that this is a question we should ask ourselves, not neglect, at least not neglect in our sitting practice. Not neglecting who am I, and not neglecting what am I. And you know, there are many teachings offered to help us consider that this, you know, this persistent sense of agency, and that there is something in addition to these five skandhas, the kind of umbrella that, and this strong feeling actually, or attitude, or built-in orientation we have that I exist, right? That I am here. And that I have agency, and there is an agent here. That's, for instance, suffering, or desiring, or thinking, or feeling, or perceiving. So many teachings, and really what Zazen practice, I believe, is meant to help us with, meant to orient us to, is to question and ultimately to be free from the notion that there's some separate suffering, desiring, perceiving. Karmically acting self. One of a teaching that I always go back to is Suzuki Roshi's teaching about the breath. And when Suzuki Roshi teaches about the breath, he doesn't just teach about the breath, he teaches about the self. And he says, if you are all students of Suzuki Roshi ultimately, so you probably know this, but he says the what we call the I is just a swinging gate. Just a swinging gate. The in-breath and the out-breath is just, he says, In that passage, he says, there is no you that you can call I. There is no you that you can call I. There's just a swinging gate. So we can sit, you know, we can sit and just gently focus on the in-breath and the out-breath. And continually let go of the notion that there is something other than, or there is something, you know, there's some I that's involved in breathing. And the and of course the breath is such a good object for our contemplation and our meditation, because we don't control it, right? I mean, I can hold my breath, or I can intentionally breathe out long or short. But also, I can, most of the time, I'm just being breathed without any intentional, without even a thought to it. It's breath is breathing me without my agency. And so what a wonderful teaching the breath is. The breath is our teacher. This life comes to us without any intervention or thought or action on our part. And the breath is a teaching that's being offered to us moment after moment. It's continually being offered to us. Breathing in and breathing out. Just this swinging gate. And, of course, we suffer. Sadly. We suffer with our conventional ideas about the self and how the self is doing in relationship to other people and our lunch and our sleep and the other cars on the road and so forth, you know. So this is, you know, this is, but, you know, we're lucky, you know, we lucky few, who have this practice and have the opportunity to experience some relief from the demands of the self, or to sit down and consider what and consider the teaching of the breath and consider the teaching of emptiness of form, feelings, perceptions, formations, and consciousness. Because, you know, the Heart Sutras tells us that Avalokiteshvara, doesn't say he sat down, doesn't say he sat sasan, he just looked down, or she looked down, and saw that all five skandhas, heaps, collections, are empty, and thus relieved all suffering. So, think it says Avalokiteshvara, clearly saw, had really good vision, you know, didn't need glasses maybe, you know, clearly saw.
We have a call coming here, Jim.
Oh, I can see this pretty well. I think it's a good morning though to say something else, and that is the feeling I think we all have that of discouragement at this moment when we see what's happening in Ukraine, that we see this aggression against a country that has not done anything to provoke it at all, except, you know, being independent. Yeah. My friend that I mentioned, who wrote the memoir, you know, she took the step of being independent, and it worked, you know, for her life, and her life became a wonderful life. And Ukrainian, it seems like Ukraine took that step, and it's really been working well. The country is doing well, and they took that step at some cost of, you know, to their people and to their society, but they were able to. And it seems like it's been working quite well. And then it's like as if my one thing, the drug addict boyfriend of my friend did not come back, and he didn't try the one virtue. I mean, I'm sure he had lots of virtues actually, even though, you know, he was addicted to heroin, but he didn't try to stop my friend from becoming independent. He was upset about it ultimately, because she left him, she realized she had to get away from his addiction and his violence, actually. But he didn't try to stop her. So he had more virtue, you know, than Putin, you know. So it's really sad, very sad to see that kind of naked aggression against a peaceful country that is simply trying to develop, you know, what, to become independent, to be independent, and, you know, to have a economy that to have self-governance and to not be corrupt. These are noble impulses. And so it's very sad to see, extremely sad to see the force of, you know, we would say Mara, you know, kind of the force of Mara coming in to stop, to crush that independent spirit. So I'll just end. Maybe we can have some dialogue. You know, I think that for me, there's many answers to this question: who am I? I think there's many ways we can look at it, many perspectives we can take on it, and I just offer that. I think for Zen students, you know, should consider that. One of the answers to that question is, I am a person of intention. I'm a person who chooses a certain way of life, and I choose a path of non-violence, non-harming, and deliberate and
Lord dedicated introspection, deliberate and dedicated introspection, and also myself, I realize that I fail many times to to not be under the sway, for instance, of my thinking or my perceptions or my karmic formations. I fail many times to not see clearly the emptiness. I love this expression of Dogen. He says, something like, most of the time, we fail to hit the mark. We fail to hit the mark. Most of the time. He says, I don't know, I forget, he says, like 99 times out of 100 or something, he says, we fail to hit the mark. But he says, it's our repeated failures. Says this, it's our repeated failures to hit the mark that enable hitting the mark in this present moment. It's our repeated failures. This is encouragement. You know? So no matter how much we fail, how often we think we're such a backward practitioner in a way. Take heed to this teaching from Dogen. It's our repeated failures to hit the mark that enable hitting the mark right now. Thank you very much. What about you?
I'm also a recovering alcoholic, and I was thinking, I remember John Briggs being here, and I always, it seemed like this weird lapse in memory. I was like, why did I not know him? And as I thought back, I realized, oh, that was really the peak of me recovering. I was going to AA meetings instead of coming here. That's why. But you think of, my wife works with children, and she teaches me about scaffolding. And all development is scaffolding. So you build a platform and you climb up on it. And alcohol becomes a scaffold. So you build a platform and you find a bond. And in reference to your talk, you start to wonder what is going to happen to you when this big platform you just built is gone. And what a developmental decline. You don't think about it in that way, but it becomes, who am I without this big platform? And you can't see it. You can't imagine what your life is without that platform. But it becomes, once it's gone, once someone knocks it out with a hammer, you start to you can't answer the question. I don't know that you can ever answer the question, who am I? But
do you then build a new platform that is more solid or more wholesome?
Yes.
I mean, because you said all development is scaffold.
Right.
There's a word there, development.
Yep. Right? And so there's wholesome development, there's wholesome scaffolding,
right.
And there's unwholesome scaffolding. And yeah, and thank you, because it is scary to knock down any scaffolding that we built.
Yeah.
I understand that. It's a very scary thing to, because we built it. We think we did.
Yeah.
You know? I built this platform. It was a really rickety, lousy platform, and it really wasn't serving me very well, but it was my platform.
Well, and you discovered too, not to belabor this, but you discovered that as you start building healthier platforms, more wholesome platforms, you have the ability to climb up and down. Because you're putting platform on platform. And this is what children do all the time. They build these platforms, they climb up to the top, and they go, I'm comfortable here.
Mm-hmm.
They climb back down a little bit. They build a different platform. And I don't think you can do that when your platform is unhealthy or unwholesome or rickety.
Right, you just have to get off.
Yeah.
Start over.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's recovery, is getting off and starting over. And but it, you know, it's hard to do, and people fall back. If this is a huge thing, right?
Sure.
John related to me his story about he gave up all his alcohol and quit. And then he went to this conference. It was up in Napa, I think, and which is not a good place to go. If you're and he, I don't know, the thing went really well. I think he gave a presentation there. It went really well. He was feeling good about himself. And he said, I can have just one glass of wine just to celebrate this wonderful moment that I have had here at this conference. Well, guess what? It wasn't one glass. It wasn't one bottle, and he was back on that path.
Yeah.
So he told me about that particular time. But ultimately, you know, he was successful. He was successful, and he became a priest, actually. And he was Shusoke here. That's quite a new scaffold. And I admired him for that.
Well, it's interesting you bring it up, John. I think we had a service for him, and we all had little stones. And I still carry mine around with me.
Oh, wow.
And think of John.
Mm-hmm.
you didn't use this term, but I think you were kind of talking about no self, and which is something I think about quite a bit. And I think I maybe only have, I can talk about it, but that's different than feeling it or having it in your gut kind of thing. And I guess the practical way I think about it is having less ego, like not being attached to things and, you know, letting somebody else take the credit or things like that. I mean, how do you go about your sort of everyday life with no self?
Well, you don't. You don't. I mean,
I was hoping you would say that.
You know, the self is a very practical adaption we've made and necessary, but it's just misleading. In you know, we have to be sort of careful about it. And the word I used was agent,
mm-hmm.
you know, or agency.
Yeah, I like that.
Or so I would say, you know, if I substituted no self and I said no agency, then that might be a helpful way of thinking about it, because it, as the going around in your life, of course. One of the things that we have to, we're always negotiating is how much agency and how much no agency here. You know, when do I need to step forward? When do I need to go up the scaffold? When do I need to come back down? You know, how much agency, and is my agency too much here? is, or is my agency not enough in daily life? Mm-hmm. Something we have, we need to, sometimes we don't step forward enough. We don't assert ourselves enough. Sometimes we do too much. We do too much. So one of the helpful things about practice is that it's practice. I think, you know, it may be the case, you know, for men, that practice helps us step back, because we tend to, generally speaking, step forward a little too much, you know. So, you know, in terms of daily life, we don't go around without a sense of agency. With the guidance and support of practice, we go around aware of agency and non-agency. When can I just sit back and listen and just appreciate this scene, that these things that are happening, and maybe we need to expand. Some of us need to expand that kind of letting go of just letting, you know, letting others be others. Have you ever heard of that expression? Mm-hmm. Letting others be others, and let yourself be yourself. But I think this is part of, you know, answering who am I question in a way. Mm-hmm. Who do I need to be now? Do I need to be, I mean, when you're Jisha, you need to be Jisha, fully be Jisha, you know, and help me do the things and bring the table and so forth. But then, you know, when sitting zazen, don't need to be Jisha. Just sit. And just let go of being Jisha. And me, I do the ritual of being a priest. When I sit zazen, I'm not a priest. I'm just sitting. Well, I think I'm right on time here. 11:20. Mary told me that's about the time to end. Okay. So nice to be with you guys again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Do I need to
close the view just to your hands?
Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow.